I call tonight's talk 21st Century Buddha, and primarily it's a talk on the Four Noble Truths with special emphasis on the three kinds of craving. But first question, is Buddhism relevant in the 21st century? After all, the 21st century is very secular, it's very materialistic, it's very pragmatic, it's driven by a need for reason and scientific rigour. In many respects, religion per se has been somewhat marginalised. Fewer people are going to church, this sort of thing. Does a teaching like that of the Buddha's have a place, especially considering the age of the Buddha's teaching, 2,500 years he taught. That was before the ancient Romans invaded this country. That's an awfully long time ago, in a very different culture that he taught in. Does the Buddha's teaching therefore have any relevance in this modern age? Well, the simple answer is yes, it does. More comprehensive answer as to why, though? Well, firstly, in terms of the time factor, on the internet I found an interesting article explaining that if you took the time since what science regarded as the beginning of the universe, the Big Bang, till now, and you fitted it all into a 24-hour period, so where we are now is 12 midnight after a 24-hour period, then in that case, Homo sapiens appeared on the Earth 160,000th of a second ago. And the Buddha famously sat under the tree and became enlightened 4 millionths of a second ago. So when you put it into perspective like that, perhaps it isn't so very long ago after all. When the Buddha became enlightened, he became enlightened to what he called the Four Noble Truths. And the Four Noble Truths represent his fundamental teaching, from whence sprang all the other teachings that came from that. His enlightenment was the realization, firstly, of the truth of suffering, that life is suffering. Secondly, that suffering does indeed have a cause. And the cause of suffering is the craving for life to be different, which itself is born of ignorance, a blindness to the way life really is. The third noble truth was that there is a cessation to that suffering, and that cessation of suffering comes from a complete recognition of the way life truly is. So freeing ourselves from the blindness, from the delusion, frees us from craving for life to be different, and hence suffering. And of course, the fourth noble truth was that in that moment he discovered the way out. We can't... The truth of nibbana, of enlightenment, is non-communicable. Each has to find it for themselves. Buddhas do but show the way. But that's what the historical Buddha did. He was able to establish a way out of suffering that anyone could follow with sufficient determination and devotion. It is possible to come to the complete cessation of suffering. Now, these are truths because they are a representation, a reflection of the way life truly is. And the Buddha maintained that these are eternal truths, that they exist regardless of whether there is a Buddha arising in the world to make them known, the Buddha simply becomes aware of them and then teaches them. They relate to basic, fundamental, the basic and fundamental nature of the human condition. So it is true for all human beings. And therefore, it would be suitable, the Buddha's teaching would be suitable in at any time and in any culture. But of course, we needn't take anybody's word for it. Are the Four Noble Truths relevant in this 21st century? When talking of the First Noble Truth, the fact of suffering in life, the Buddha was to say, birth is suffering, aging is suffering, disease is suffering, death is suffering, grief, sorrow, lamentation, pain and despair are suffering. To be united with the things we don't like is suffering. To be separated from the things that we love is suffering. To not get what we want is suffering. And he summed it up by saying the five groups of grasping are suffering. And that relates to the higher teaching, where we explore the real building blocks of experience and come to see how utterly fleeting, transient and ungraspable life truly is. So in the 21st century, do any of those kinds of qualities manifest? Well, I watched a very interesting video recently, as part of my research for my book, of course. It was of a video that somebody had constructed very cleverly, where you are, as it were, looking through the eyes of a man who's looking into the mirror when he's doing his shaving and so forth. And it starts with him as a little tiny little boy, and he has to clamber up on a stool to get a look into the mirror, and one of his baby teeth fall out. And then it follows him as he goes through the seven ages of man. So you see him as the adolescent, worried about his spots. You see him developing this confidence and this swagger in his early 20s, and suddenly there's tattoos and this, you know, he started shaving and all this business. And then you see him with his little baby and his wife, and then it goes on, and it takes you through the whole aging process. And so he starts to get grey. At one point, the whole video gets really blurry, and the next time you see him, he's wearing glasses. And you know, and then finally you see him as this really old, decrepit man in the last few years of his life. And it kind of goes, yeah, nice film, thank you. Thank you for doing that. And yet there's a part of you going, oh, because of the inevitability of aging. Is aging, disease, death, grief, sorrow, lamentation, pain and despair, something that we have to deal with in this 21st century? Of course it is. What about the second noble truth? The Buddha enumerated three kinds of craving. Craving for sensual pleasures, craving for becoming, and craving for non-becoming. And I'll be going through those again a little later. Craving for sensual pleasures. Does craving for sensual pleasures occur in the 21st century? Well, of course it does. What's the whole advertising industry based on? It's based on our craving for things, wanting more and more things, fresh experiences, new sensory delights, of course. There's craving for sensual pleasures. Becoming? Craving for becoming? Despite the fact that it's the most difficult job in the world, and it sends the person, whoever the person is in that job, it sends their hair grey. In November, of course, they'll be holding the US elections for a new president. And there's more than a few people that are quite willing to take on that role. And that's what becoming is all about. It's all about this sense of, I will become that which I want to be, and through doing that I will find peace and happiness and so forth. So is that drive for becoming, the craving for becoming, evident in the 21st century? Well, of course it is. Craving for non-becoming, on the other hand, is wanting to keep things the same, not wanting things to change. And given that change is a fundamental hallmark of life, then that's of course going to engender a lot of suffering. And we need only look at the situation in, say, a place like Syria currently, where certain people are hanging on to dear life trying to keep the political situation the same, when it appears quite a few other people want it to be different. So craving for non-becoming is very prevalent in the 21st century. The third noble truth is Nibbana. Does that have relevance in the 21st century? Well, if you look behind, and I know this is something I talk about a lot, but if you look behind the craving, what it is that people are truly wanting, what they truly aspire to, it is the cessation of suffering. It is the peace and happiness, the lack of worry, the lack of fears that truly people want. Yes, and it can work temporarily. You can become peaceful as a consequence of indulging your senses. For instance, the restlessness of the craving is lost because we've satiated our need, but only temporarily. Of course, it's not too long before the craving re-emerges. The Buddha himself said, even those that have not entered into a training like this experience Nibbana. Nibbana is simply the cessation of suffering. However, the Nibbana we mean is the permanent cessation of suffering, which is a rather different matter, but it is, deep down, what everyone is looking for. Now, as for the path, does the path itself, the Noble Eightfold Path, does that itself have relevance in today's world? Now, if I may, I'd like to answer that in a rather convoluted hopefully not too convoluted way, but take a bit of a detour. Again, on my travels through the internet, I came across a description. I was looking for reasons why we have such a secular, materially driven, and, if I dare say it, somewhat sceptical society these days. And I came across this quote by a professor of European history at the University of Rochester in America, called Dorinda Outram. And she said this: a desire for human affairs to be guided by rationality rather than by faith, superstition, or revelation. A belief in the power of human reason to change society and liberate the individual from the restraints of custom or arbitrary authority. All backed up by a worldview increasingly validated by science rather than by religion or traditions. And I thought, well, that's it. That was a perfect description of life as it is in the 21st century. But actually what she was talking about was the driving force for the what was called the Age of Reason that took place 400 years ago. Well, no wonder we are the way we are in society these days, generally speaking. It's kind of got coded into our DNA. It's been with us for this principle, this ideal of what Kant, the philosopher Immanuel Kant, summed up as the freedom to use one's own intelligence. We want to know for ourselves. We don't want to be told what's true. And that's got really deeply embedded in our culture. And I think that's a very important point to bear in mind. Now, some people might consider that to be at odds with the spiritual teaching. For instance, like the Buddha's telling us what life's like. But the beauty, of course, of the Buddha's teaching is its emphasis on finding out for oneself. Buddhas do but point the way. You have to find out for yourself. So it's actually very much relevant to the 21st century and 21st century attitudes. But it did occur to me that for all these hundreds of years of applying ourselves to this principle, and all the wonderful things that have come from applying intellect and reason and logic to the problems of the world, it still hasn't got us free from suffering. There's a couple of examples that came to mind that I thought I'd mention. The first is smartphones. Does anyone know how a smartphone works? I mean, I don't mean, you turn it on and then, you can use your fingers and, you can do this and do that and you've got apps and you can even make telephone calls. What I mean is, if somebody took away all the smartphones, would you be able to make one? Would you know what to do? And of course the answer is no. And that counts for so much of in this technological age, that we are actually still dependent on other people's knowledge. And therefore, that dependency means that there's still dukkha, still suffering, because the fear of the loss of these, and it's not just gadgets, but the fear of the loss of this technology is the fear of the sense of the fear that comes from the dependency and the fear of losing the things that we depend on for our happiness. That's what I'm trying to say. And now we've got such a technologically integrated society that there is always this lurking threat of the system going haywire. And so it hasn't solved the problem of suffering because there's still a dependency. Not that there's anything inherently wrong with smartphones or technology. It's not right or wrong, it's just showing up its limitations. The other one that sprang to mind was this relegation of religion and religious and spiritual values has had a detrimental effect, and there's a growing body of people that are desperately asking for a kind of universal value system, a system of values that we can all agree upon as being right and proper, and therefore we can educate our children properly and in morality and ethics and so forth. But whose definition of right are we going to use? Are we going to use liberal Western values, or are we going to use more fundamental religious values? Who's right and who's got it not so right? Tricky problem. Buddha Dhamma, the problem is solved because we have to find out for ourselves. That's the guiding principle. The understanding that we can gain through Buddha Dhamma can free us from all suffering. It can also show us firsthand, directly, not through any intermediary, what genuinely leads to an increase in our suffering and what genuinely leads to a decrease in our suffering. So it goes, in a sense, it goes beyond the remit of the age of reason. It actually fulfills, because we're not left dependent upon other people's knowledge, we're not left dependent on other people's idea of right and wrong. We can find out through our own experience what leads to genuine reduction in suffering. So in that way, again, the path, the Noble Eightfold Path, is entirely relevant to the principles and the attitudes of people today. So how do we determine right? I mean, the Noble Eightfold Path is set up in terms of right view, right aspiration, right action, right speech, right livelihood, right effort, right concentration, and right mindfulness. Well, there is only one way, and that is to actually practice. That's the Buddha's recommendation. He says it's that you find out through applying the teaching, having faith in the teaching, applying it to your life, and finding out what happens. So the training requires a certain amount of study, listening to talks like this, finding out about such things as the Four Noble Truths. Especially important is, of course, putting it all into practice and finding out experientially the true nature of the Four Noble Truths. And ultimately, in the end, the fulfillment of the training is to get the direct intuitive comprehension, the same direct intuitive comprehension that the Buddha awakened to. That is the culmination of the training. So if we look, just to help broaden that out so you understand what I mean by that, if we look at the Four Noble Truths in terms of what happens, can happen in meditation. Meditation is, of course, all about closely observing, noting what actually takes place in our experience. We find through that process of that close, almost microscopic observation of experience, that we start to notice patterns of behaviour that we actually perform in our lives generally. So if you like, the meditation is a microcosm. It shows us the patterns of the macro, the bigger world. It shows us exactly what it is that we get up to. So in a meditation, craving for sensual pleasures, how might that arise in the meditation? Always seeking pleasure. It's the pursuit of pleasure. It's the dissatisfaction with what's going on. Apparently in the meditation, finding it uninteresting, boring even, and allowing the mind to cast away to happier times in the past, or perhaps dreaming of happier times to come. But those dreams will be centred around sensual enjoyment in some form or other. Or it might arise as the attempt always, say, moving the body around because the body is uncomfortable and you believe that the body should always be in a pleasant state. So always trying to find that just that right place to sit so that everything's pleasant and nice. All of which is ignoring the way it actually is and trying to make it different. So it's the drive for pleasure. In meditation, how might craving for becoming manifest? It might be, for instance, that there's a predetermined idea of what meditation states should be, an ideal. And so we find that the meditation isn't like that, and we want to make it like that. So we start manipulating and controlling the meditation to try and turn it into what we had assumed meditation should be, which again avoids looking at what is actually taking place. So the mind is always... Becoming has always that sense of pushing. You know, earlier I was saying it's about being there in the middle. It's about being content with what is actually occurring in the moment without wanting to push into another experience. That's the craving for becoming. And the craving for non-becoming, how does that manifest itself? I really must go and see the optician, or write bigger, one of the two. It's getting ridiculous. Oh, yes, of course. It's the reluctance to give up things. Of course, craving for non-becoming is wanting things to stay the same and not change. And so when we get caught up in non-becoming in the meditation, it might very well be that the meditation is going very as we thought it should. And what arises then is this tenacity, this sense of not wanting it to change. And as a result, a fear arising that it will, which of course completely destroys the good positive states that we're enjoying anyway. So again, it's out of kilter with reality, because There are some times with the meditation, you know, when you've got to let go. Because meditation is maturing and it wants to go into new areas. It's always taking us into the unknown. We can't cling to the known. There are some times when you just have to let the meditation go all wobbly and out of control. And then miraculously it all reforms. And suddenly you're at a new level. And you're perhaps observing more closely. Perhaps you've begun to notice one of the marks, one of the three marks in great detail. So there are times when we mustn't cling, when we must allow the meditation to move on. And how do we feel as a result of craving in the meditation? Well, pretty worn out usually, pretty dissatisfied. We didn't get what we wanted out of the meditation, and sometimes it can be very painful, especially when that goal orientation, that drive for progress comes in. So from our experience, that direct experience through the meditation, we begin to see for ourselves how these three kinds of craving really do begin to create a lot of suffering for us. And how are they overcome? Three cravings? Well, firstly, by a lot of hard work and commitment, especially to the setting up of mindfulness. There has to be great awareness of what's going on in mind and body, a willingness to note our experiences, both externally and internally, so that we begin to get a really good understanding experientially of what craving actually is, what it feels like, and what it produces, and indeed where it comes from. There are two aspects to overcoming three kinds of craving. One is a temporary measure, and then having achieved the temporary measure, you can work on the permanent measure. The temporary measure is to learn to restrain the craving when it arises, hence why you need such good mindfulness. The ability to step out of that craving, to be able to note, oh, this is craving for sensual pleasures, perhaps, or this is craving for becoming. The very noting helps you just get a little bit of distance on what's going on, enough to then restrain acting in that way further. And that's a very critical thing to understand, is that it's not about putting up a wall and stopping that craving from happening, because no matter how high you make that wall, the craving will always get over the top. And you just build up this huge resistance if you try that. The way to restrain craving when it does arise is to fully accept its presence. To fully accept that craving is in the mind and not seek to remedy the problem. Which takes time, takes dedication. But with all the aspects of the training in place, you can do it. Everyone can do it. In fact, everyone does do it. There are times when we all voluntarily, quite freely, happily restrain acting upon craving. We just don't notice, and it's developing this capacity of mindfulness to recognise actually we are quite skillful at restraining craving when we see that it's in our best interest. So you have to be able to temporarily put craving to one side. Another way of putting it is you have to put the hindrances to meditation to one side in order to get a calm mind, calm enough to then begin the observation of transience in detail. And it's that observation of transience in detail that is the permanent solution to the problem of suffering and releases us from the grip of craving. The roots of craving go very deep, and so our observation of life has to go very, very deep, hence the need for meditation. We really do have to ultimately get into the minutiae of experience to see the arising and passing away of all kinds of physical and mental phenomena moment by moment. It's a truly it's an amazing path of discovery. But in doing so, we see the truly transient nature of experience, that change is is in every little aspect of life. I've often spoken to you about the getting deeply into the insight meditation, and it just being a river of experience arising and passing, never the same for two moments. And as we see transience, we also see the conditioned nature of all experience. And we begin to see how little control actually we do have of experience. That it is very much an impersonal process. Things arise and pass away, not due to any self or any other, but just simply due to one thing being there, another thing arises, and when that ceases, that other thing ceases also. Yeah. That process of digging up the roots of craving, ultimately, and you do have to dig up all the roots of the craving. It's, I've used the analogy of it's like making a souffle and you're using the egg whites but not the yolks, but even if a sliver of egg yolk gets in the white doesn't thicken. While there's any residue at any level of craving for life to be different than it is, the gateway to nirvana remains resolutely sealed. People often, we talk about nirvana as being freedom from craving, and we believe that it is it's possible to fall into the belief that it is seeing nirvana that frees you from craving. It isn't. You have to be free of craving first. And that's what the path does. That's what the Buddhist path does. It takes away all that craving. Once that craving is removed, there is no more ignoring of experience. And because there's no more ignoring of experience, nirvana is revealed in all its glory, for want of a better word. So the path is tricky, it's subtle, it's deep, but it does result in this freedom from this craving and this ability to see life as it really is, as it truly is. Summing up, you're right there. Our culture demands freedom to find out things for ourselves. And Buddhism offers us a framework to find things out for ourselves. It gives us the ability to find out what is right and what is wrong, not according to anybody else, not according to the Buddha, not according to all the great teachers that have come down, spiritual teachers that have come down through the years, simply according to your own experience and what you find from your practice. So it shows us what is right, it shows us what is wrong, what doesn't work, what leads to an increase in suffering. And it also shows us what lies beyond both right and wrong, which is nirvana. You cannot describe nirvana. It is not a state. It is, if you like, the realization of the true nature of all states. So it transcends all states, it transcends our ability to describe it. But what you can talk about is what it feels like. And it's quite delightful, because the mind is serenely quiet. Even in the midst of activity, even in the midst of difficult and trying circumstances, there is a quietude that is... So whatever's going on the surface, going on the surface, but there is a quietude, a depth of peace, which is the absence of craving for life to be different. But it's also the absence of that existential angst of not understanding life, because it has been thoroughly comprehended through insight. Life has been totally understood. It doesn't mean, it's not omniscient knowledge, it doesn't mean you know how to, suddenly you do know how to put a smartphone together or anything like that. It's a knowledge of the fundamental true nature of existence. And it's a complete understanding that life could not be different than it is. But the way it is always changing. It's never the same for two moments. And so there's this supreme ability to adapt to circumstances. One isn't tied, one isn't set, one isn't fixed. So there's this amazing ability to just dance with life and just make it up as you go along. Which is all any of us are doing actually anyway. So there's no existential angst, there's no fear of death. Laugh in the face of death. Because everything, absolutely everything, is arising and passing away moment by moment and is never repeated. So what is there to die? Yeah. And there's a certain knowing beyond all words. So there is no more hankering. There is no more questioning. There is no more confusion. And so it's just empty of all that. It's just all that is just missing. And you're free to just carry on as you see fit. It really is truly, truly marvellous. And worth absolutely anything you're willing to give in order to discover it for yourselves.